Chapter 18. Anniversary. 8th May, 2089. Namir is baking a cake. It's everyone's anniversary. We took off exactly 1 year ago, and everyone is still alive. The notebook says that on Earth it's 16th July, 89, so relativity has shrunk about 70 days off our calendar. It does feel like 12 months have gone by, though, rather than 14. So, a time for taking stock. In 1 year, only 1 day of violence, back in September, when Moonboy broke Elsa's nose, and Dustin parted his hair with a pool cue. For a long time now, Dustin and Moonboy have been civil with each other, and Elsa has lost her nasal accent. Elsa has also fucked every man aboard except Paul, if he's telling the truth, and Meryl as well, in a three-way with Moonboy, though that seems to have petered out. The avocado tree has blossomed, but set no fruit in spite of assiduous pollination. We've asked Earth for advice, but they're a half-light year away, so it will be a while. Most of the other crops are thriving. We've almost doubled the floor space allotted to tomatoes, trimming the real estate from leafy greens and legumes. Namir needed more Italian plum tomatoes for sauces, and no one complained. I wish we'd brought more fruit trees myself, or more acreage. Enough grapes to make our own wine. The idea of waiting for it to ferment is attractive, something to look forward to. Can't have everything. The planners were wise to design such a large hydroponic garden, even though we could survive without it. Having regular menial chores helps keep us sane. Caring for living things promotes optimism, even in our situation. In the sports news, I'm now swimming 2 kilometers a day. There's a new house rule in billiards. Namir has to shoot left-handed, or no one will play with him. He still wins, but not all the time anymore. On Saturdays, we move all the lounge furniture to the walls, string a badminton net across the room, and work up a good sweat. The Martians come out and play for the first few minutes, one on each team, though they overheat quickly and are handicapped by the gravity, not to mention lacking the concept of sport. We compensate for their relative lack of mobility by letting them each use 2 rackets. They're ambidextrous 4 ways. Meryl's wall-sized crossword puzzle is about a third finished. She'd better slow down. Elsa put away her needlepoint for a while, but has started a new one, another fractal chromatic fantasy. Moonboy spends an hour or two a day on the piano, composing silently, and sometimes plays all night, haggard but happy in the morning. I don't read music too well, but noticed the other day that Composition 3, Approach/Retreat, is 35 pages long. Paul spends most of the mornings drinking coffee and cranking out equations, which he sometimes tries to explain to me. He won't be through coursework on the doctorate for another 1.5 years. Then he'll write a dissertation and send it off to Earth. So maybe in 50 years he'll get a doctorate in quaint astrophysics from Stanford. If there still is a Stanford. Namir is working on another balalaika, a long one with low notes, and is slowly carving a bust of Elsa, which is at a creepy stage. Half of it is still a block of wood, and half a mostly finished sculpture, as if she were being pulled out of the material. Straight on, I think her expression is one of stoic acceptance. From another angle, her lips slightly apart, she looks like she's on the verge of an orgasm. He knows her better than any of us, of course. Maybe that's what she looks like all the time, to him. I've taken up drawing again, using the texts Oz recommended when I was first on Mars. No paper, but it was a lifetime ago when I last had paper to spare. I could adjust the stylus and notebook to simulate pencil, ink, or wash. I'm copying some faces from the actual book that Namir brought along. All of Vermeer. His The Geographer looks a lot like Moonboy, though his hair isn't white. Our brand new spaceship is getting a little worn around the edges. The air recycler started making a noise like a person whistling through her teeth, barely audible. Paul described it to the auto-repair algorithm, and the noise stopped for a few days, then came back. Meryl did it a slightly different way, and it stayed quiet. But it was a scary time. Can't send out for parts. The Martian swimming pool has to be continuously recaulked. Long hours of immersion, totally unnatural, of course, for Martians, must do something with the chemistry of their skin, which makes the water react with the caulking compound. Try to get those two out of the water, though. Along with Meryl and Moonboy, I'm chipping away at the Martian language. Snowbird is more helpful than Flying Amber, but even so, it's a frustrating experience. Moonboy is developing a good ear for using the synthesizer to simulate Martian sounds, and, in a real sense, he's the only one of us who can speak Martian with anything like a useful vocabulary. With merely human larynx and vocal cords, I can do about 300 words that Snowbird can recognize consistently, but many of those, like swimming, are neologisms derived from human sounds. Moonboy can play more than 10 times my number of words, but a similar problem is emerging. We can only talk about experiences that humans and Martians share. Most of what they do and think is hidden from us. Some may even be hidden on purpose. We have no idea what their secret agenda might be. They might not even know. When the lone other communicated to us from Neptune's satellite Triton, it did so at first through a long rote message that Flying Amber and other members of his family recited after a hypnotic stimulus. They translated it for us, but how complete was the translation? How honest? We must always keep in mind that the Martians were created by the others for the sole purpose of contacting us after we developed the ability to go to Mars. We were no danger to them until then. This is the only thing that lone other said to us in a human language in response to our first message. Peace is a good sentiment. Your assumption about my body chemistry is clever but wrong. I will tell you more later. At this time, I do not wish to tell you where my people live. I have been watching your development for a long time, mostly through radio and television. If you take an objective view of human behavior since the early 20th century, you can understand why I must approach you with caution. I apologize for having destroyed your Triton probe back in 2044. I didn't want you to know exactly where I am on this world. If you send another probe, I will do the same thing. Again, with apologies. For reasons that may become apparent soon, I don't wish to communicate with you directly. The biological constructs that live below the surface of Mars were created thousands of years ago, with the sole purpose of eventually talking to you and, at the right time, serving as a conduit through which I could reveal my existence. Our existence, actually, since we have millions of individuals elsewhere. On our home planet and watching other planets, like yours. This is a clumsy and limited language for me, as are all human languages. The Martian ones were created for communication between you and me, and from now on, I would like to utilize the most complex of those Martian languages, which is used by only one individual, the leader you call Red. When the other sent this message to us, it must have known that within a few days the delayed action bomb within Red would go off and destroy all higher forms of life on Earth. So, why did it bother? Most of us think it was hedging its bets in case, as did happen, the human race figured out a way around the doomsday bomb. Namir believes it assumed we would solve the puzzle and survive. A subtle difference. Red might have figured it out before he died. He had talked with the other, or at least listened to it. And on his way to the moon and doom, he talked non-stop about it for almost 20 hours. Every word was recorded, but it hasn't yet been translated. Only one Martian, his successor, will be able to comprehend it. And when we left, she was still studying the language. The long transition period between one leader's death and the education of the succeeding leader was never a problem before humans came along. Martian daily life was simple and predictable, and if something came up in the dozen or two Aries while they were leaderless, it would just have to wait. We had dessert in the compromise lounge, so the Martians could comfortably join us, even though the human year is irrelevant to their calendar. We had taken a plastic bottle of Tej, Ethiopian honey wine, out of the luxury stores. It went well with the coffee and honey cake recipe Namir remembered from his childhood, some Jewish tradition. Either would be poison to the Martians, of course, but they brought out some special purple fungus and what looked and smelled like sulfurous swamp water. I held up my glass to them and croaked out a greeting that was traditional for such occasions, which roughly translates as, well, another year. Snowbird and Amir exchanged toasts in Japanese and bowed, which in the case of the Martian looked weirdly like a horse in dressage. Plastic glasses were clicked all around. The cake was sinfully excellent. "We should have this every day," Elsa said. "In 5 years, we'll be bigger than the Martians." "That would be attractive," Fly and Amber admitted. "But I don't think you have that much honey." "You can never tell when they're joking. They have the same complaint about us." Moonboy had a small synth keyboard, and he played a few words for Snowbird, who responded with a thrumming, crackling sound, and then the thump of laughter. "I told her she was looking slim," he said, "and she answered that the food here was lousy." That was actually a pretty subtle joke. Martians don't much care what they eat, but she knew about that attitude from humans. After we finished the cake and Tej, we switched to regular wine and other alcohol, and Snowbird asked whether Namir would bring out his balalaika and do a duet with Moonboy. Namir asked Dustin whether he could stand it, and he said that once a year wouldn't kill him. By the time Namir had retrieved the balalaika from the workshop, Moonboy had figured out how to simulate a primitive accordion, and with his sensitive ear, he had no trouble squeezing out chords that matched the Eastern European and Israeli tunes Namir knew, and did an occasional simulated clarinet solo, what he called klezmer style. Most of it was new to me, and I was glad of the Martian request. When we went to bed, Paul and I made love, even though it wasn't Saturday. Badminton brings out the beast in him. Afterwards, he was restless. "I'm the most useless pilot in history." "I don't know. The guy in charge of the Titanic didn't exactly earn his paycheck." "This morning while you were gardening, I went up to the shuttle and put it through some simulations for landing." "A few years premature." "Practice makes perfect?" "I could do them in my sleep, which is the problem. There are really only 4 basic situations in the VR. Earth, Mars, Moon, and 0G rendezvous. I can fiddle with the parameters, but I'm not really learning anything." "Well, it's not rocket science, as they used to say, except that it is rocket science. And you're the best. I read that somewhere." I could feel his smile in the dark, and he patted my hip. "The best within a half light year, anyhow. But we should have thought to make up some weird simulations, like a dense, turbulent atmosphere, a dusty one. You'd never land in a dust storm if you had a chance. But I'll have to take what I get." "Well, it's just software, isn't it? Describe what you need and tight beam it to Earth. They could develop and test it and send it to you after turnaround." He paused. "Sometimes you surprise me." I resisted the impulse to reach down and actually surprise him. It was already late, though, and I didn't want to give him any more ideas.